Well, good evening. Kisayo, it's good to see you. Yeah. And we have a new face tonight. You brought a friend, Joseph. Let's do introductions around.
I'm Donald Lynn.
Britt.
Jeffrey.
Marie.
Dom.
Samuel.
Wendy, Ellie,
Sarah.
Sarah, welcome.
Thank you.
I'm a little sleepy tonight. I swept part of the driveway this afternoon, and it was a new experience after a year and a half or so. I kind of nodded off because it's so hot and from the heater, and then the heater woke me up, and I thought, oh, thank you. Went ding. So we approached the questions. The first chapter is called The King's Request. And so the king, the ten-headed king, requested the Buddha to explain. And Buddha began explaining. And so... Because Mahamati was there and had been to other Buddha lands, together with other wise bodhisattvas, it says. Now he rose and, pressing his hands together and bowing in reverence, he started praising the Buddha, like a flower in the sky. Transcending mind and consciousness, all things are like illusions. In the light of your wisdom and compassion, they neither are nor aren't. The world is but a dream, neither permanent nor transient. In the light of your wisdom and compassion, it neither is nor isn't. So he presents this basic notion that you can't really put your finger on anything and say it is. Nothing is in a final, perfect, permanent way, whatever you want to call it. It could be called something else. It could be something else. This pretty little table could turn into a chew toy for a dog, and or a piece of firewood. Anything could be like that. We ourselves could just be a piece of meat for a mountain lion. And the mountain lion would not even know that we thought we were somebody. it's a funny way to think, but it's the truth of it, actually. And that's what this is about, is trying to get at the underneath part of the truth, the things that we take for granted aren't really. And if we believe in them without a little grain of salt or two or three, if we take it all so seriously, then we miss the boat. We don't understand. So after he'd finished his praises, verses in praise of the Buddha, Mahamati introduced himself. He said, "My name is Mahamati. To plumb the depths of the Mahayana, I come before the Perfect One with 108 questions." 108 is a classic number. We ring the bell 108 times at New Year. It's a multiple of nine. So there's some sort of mystical, magical thing about the number 108, though it goes so far back that nobody really knows. But it's interesting to see it showing up here because this is 400 AD or something like that. It's really old. So then Buddha said, on hearing this request, told this son of Buddhas, ask your questions, son of victors. Ask and I will explain the realm of personal realization. Personal realization. And that is the basis of this whole sutra. That's what this is about. What it is to be what we are. Even though I just said there isn't any being, still something is happening. And then this whole chapter, which is quite long, continues with the questions. How is thinking purified? Where does it come from? How should we regard delusion, and where does it come from? That's the first question. I encourage you all to read this. I'm not going to go through all these millions of questions. It's not 108, it's 90-something, but it's a ton of them. And some of them are kind of silly or dreamy. Why does the world not arise nor cease? How is it like a flower in the sky? Why are there wind and clouds in the sky? Why are elephants, horses, and deer trapped and caught by men? Why shouldn't we eat meat? Why are lands and kingdoms shaped like the sun or moon? Etc., etc. And there are a million footnotes, and on each page the footnotes appear on the left side and the teaching on the right. And it's just the basic Buddha teaching, the Buddhist teaching. And it's well defined by Red Pine, very beautifully done. So if you can read this and read the footnotes, you'll end up with a lot of basic knowledge of Buddhism. Now, if you're just starting out, it probably isn't even necessary, not even advisable. You don't want to fill your head with a lot of information if you're just learning to sit. But once you've had a real experience of tasting sitting, then these things are very helpful to know about. And so I encourage you to read this. And if these words appear farther down the line in the rest of the material, he defines them again. So that's one of the joys of this book, is that he doesn't make you fumble and look all the way through it to try to connect with it again. It's all right here. It's a very, very nicely done book. Where do food and drink come from? What gives rise to sexual desire? What constitutes a king, a minor regent, or a chakravartin? All that is number 25. Just, you can imagine Buddha sitting there thinking, what shall I say to this guy? It's very long. So it goes on until page 61, section 3. And section 3, it's about form. and about personal realization. So, and it's about the same thing about if you posit one thing, you're also positing the other thing at the same time. If you posit dry, the other side of dry is wet. The other side of war is peace. If you say peace, it means the absence of war. If you say dry, it means the absence of wet. So all these statements that Buddha is making, a statement about passion is about no passion. A statement about purity is about no purity. If you bring up something, it's a word for something that can't be defined. So it's what Red Pine says is Buddha's explanation of dharmas and non-dharmas that he did in chapter 1, that all dharmas are non-dharmas. They're nothing more than arbitrary designations behind which nothing is real, in the sense that I just said. That this table is a very handy, very familiar and friendly and useful object of our attention that we project as a table. We call it a table. We assume it's a table and we assume it's out there. But it's only a table as long as we call it that. And we don't have to call it that. In fact, it could be a tish or a tabla. I don't know any other languages, but if you're German, that's a tish. And it would seem very silly to call it a table. So it is a table, but it's not a table. It's a thing, but it's not a thing. And it's one thing, but it's also a part of everything. So we don't live like that with our objects. But if we actually think that they're totally solid and need to stay exactly the same all the time, then we get very upset when they change. It doesn't mean that they're not there. And Dr. Johnson, when Bishop Barclay proclaimed this same truth, he kicked a rock and said, "That's real, that's solid. What do you think about that?" But that isn't what Bishop Barclay meant. So it's about how we use our mind in our encounter with our mind, with what appears in our life and world. How it is that we are what we are. So Buddha goes through this long, long thing about everything. He doesn't address every single thing that Mahamati mentioned, but you would think he was doing it. It's such a long, long piece of stuff. A statement about delight is whatever is present about no delight in whatever is present. A statement about self-existence, about no self-existence. A statement about intellect is about blah, blah, blah. And the last one is a statement about support is about no support. A statement about words is about no words. Mahamati, these 108 answers were spoken by the Buddhas of the past. These are what you and other bodhisattvas should study. So this is his reply. which is no reply. Very tricky, very tricky. So, section four, Mahamati begins to ask a little slower. And the Buddha begins to teach a little bit slower. So that Mahamati asked, Bhagavan, in how many ways do the various forms of consciousness arise, persist, and cease? So this is questioning the kinds of consciousness. And the kinds of consciousness are the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and then the mind, which has many different aspects. So in this scheme, consciousness is not just one thing. It depends on all the systems of the body first. Otherwise, we could not be conscious. Even Helen Keller had to be able to touch things in order to connect. But Helen Keller's mind was very alive and bright, and although she only had one physical aspect of consciousness, she had all the others. And so she could exercise her brilliance, even though she was so limited in her physical aspect. It's very touching to think of that. So, Buddha says there are forms of consciousness arise and continue and end. So it always has a beginning, a middle, and then it always ends. It's just like a plant that grows up and falls over and grows up and falls over. Our consciousness is like that. And some of it is produced by causes, the causes and conditions in which we find ourselves cause the mind to become activated. A cause might be a pinch or a challenge or a smell. Some of them are karmic. They are the effect of something that maybe happened long, long ago that we couldn't even put our finger on anymore. We're constantly being affected by everything that's going on and have been affected by everything, and our ancestors were too. And so everything that we are and how we be in the world is tremendously affected by this cause and effect of what we call karma. It's not my karma and your karma, the way people used to say in the hippie days. It's more like tremendous forces, vectors. You know, vectors are what physicists measure as the force, at the direction of the force. And the arrow can be very short, meaning a very short little jab, or it can be a very long one, meaning a very long, strong one. And we're being affected by those kinds of forces all the time, and have been from the beginning. And so that's a kind of consciousness, too, that produces an effect in us, even though we usually don't notice such a thing. And then there's the intrinsic aspect that is free from causes and effects. There's an intrinsic consciousness that just is. And the only reason we know this is because we know it. I mean, that's what we are. We're a consciousness peeking out of our eyes at the world and trying to figure it out. We're a thought, you could say. So the eighth consciousness, there's six and seven consciousnesses after the five. And the eighth one is the intrinsic one and the true one. And that's the one that the bodhisattva attains, I guess you would have to say, or experiences in any way, having seen through the delusion that we all carry about how we think the world is, how we imagine the world is. So the other states, all the other states but the intrinsic state, are always coming and going. And the Alyavijnana is the state of seeds, all the experiences that we've ever had as a conscious being that are constantly being touched and sprouting up and awakening us to memories of the past, intentions that we forgot and are re-engaging with, or everything that has ever happened to us is somehow carried in us and carried in the, you could say, the general intrinsic mind of the universe. That some say that the Alyavijnana is a storehouse that stores all mind, so that all thoughts are already there and we waken them up as we live and are affected by and respond to the world. So he talks about the arising and ceasing of all forms of sensory consciousness. Our perceiving consciousness functions like a clear mirror in which shapes and images appear. Although perceiving consciousness and object projecting consciousness are the cause of whether they're separate from each other or not, perceiving consciousness, Mahamati, is the result of imperceptible habit energy and imperceptible transformations, while object projecting consciousness is the result of grasping different phenomena and the habit energy of beginningless projections. So, perceiving consciousness is the recipient of karma, and the object projecting consciousness creates it. So this is all very detailed in a way that I'm not sure is necessary to memorize. And since there's so many studies of the brain now and consciousness, it's interesting to read this, but we need to read it with our 2012 mind, our 2013 mind, and take what we can from it, but not be not assume that this is absolutely correct in every way. The cessation of characteristics, when the cause of continuity ceases, continuity itself ceases. It ceases when what it depends upon and what supports it ceases. take, for example, and this makes it easier to understand, a lump of clay and particles of dust. They are neither separate nor are they not separate. The same is true of gold and ornaments. If the lump of clay and particles of dust were separate, the latter could not comprise the former, but they do. Hence, they're not separate. And yet, if they were not separate, the lump of clay could not be distinguished from the particles of dust. So, if the intrinsic aspect of our repository consciousness and the unfolding aspect of consciousness were separate, the repository consciousness could not be its cause. What ceases is not the intrinsic aspect of consciousness, only its karmic aspect. In other words, it keeps going. The continuity of consciousness does not cease. That's the main point of this section. And then number 5 is very short. Furthermore, Mahamati, there are 7 kinds of self-existence. Which could mean reality. The self-existence of origination, the self-existence of existence, the self-existence of characteristics, the self-existence of material elements, the self-existence of causes, of conditions, and of completion. And 7 kind, then the next section is 7 kinds of higher truths. The realms of mind, wisdom, knowledge, views, bodhisattva stages, etc. So Buddha is laying out his vision of the, it's a kind of introduction to the mind and to the self, so-called self-existence, which we he understands in this as a projection. So that actually we even project ourself. We don't ever see ourself. We see ourself in a mirror, so we see our reflection. But if you think about it, you've never seen your whole body. There are parts of your body that you'll never be able to see. My grandmother always said, if you can kiss your elbow, you'll turn into a boy. She can't even see your elbow. There's a lot of us we can't see. And so even our knowledge of ourself is a projection in the sense of this sort of deconstructing of our illusions about how things really are. So I'm going to stop there. And you may be totally confused by now, but maybe not. Are there questions? Yes.
Kind of a comment, but kind of a question. I've heard the saying, rest in the nature of Alaya. It's something that Tibetans say.
Mm-hmm.
And how does that, with all this talk of repository consciousness and all these different things, is there a message here that we could just rest in consciousness?
Yes, yes, absolutely. But it's a matter of practice. Alaya is a junk house, a storehouse for all the junk in all of our minds. And it only becomes a resting place. It's usually a very anxiety-ridden place. But once we see through it, once we see what it actually is, then it suddenly, as Coben said, becomes golden light. So that's what practice is about, is learning to see more clearly, to see the storehouse consciousness as more than just a bunch of anxiety-provoking junk.
Talk has been a little anxiety-provoking for me, just because of all the kinds of consciousness and all the shades of. But so that's kind of helpful to have that as a kind of an aspiration, I guess.
Yes.
That at some point that junk house wouldn't be it wouldn't be anxiety-producing. You would be able to rest.
Yes.
Rest with the nature of it.
Yes. Okay. And that's one of the messages of this sutra, or that this difficult, painful world that we experience is nirvana. But it's hard to see, hard for us to see, because our mind is obscured by all of our anxieties and our misconceptions about things. We don't see so clearly what we and who we are. Jeffrey?
The poet Robert Haas said that one of the most stubborn things that there is the names of things.
Yes.
And I was thinking in terms of the names we give ourselves and the names we give others as being those kinds of things that are most stubborn in terms of seeing through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the whole talk about the table, which is a classical discussion of that. Another thing I wanted to share was something I heard today from Kaz Tanahashi, who was splitting some sort of Rahatsu experience with Roshi Joan. And he was giving a talk at the end of their Rahatsu, which he was saying that he came up with this new word for Buddhism, and he called it ambiguism.
That works. That works pretty well.
I asked my wife, "Do you think I should tell them this?" She said, "You better not tell them that."
And of course he did.
Of course he did.
Yeah.
It's interesting to watch when mine, wants to grasp at the different levels, but then at the same time, like Ellie, it's like, oh gosh. And I start thinking. And the intrinsic, the last level, the eighth level, the intrinsic level, is that also called like the big mind of, or the Buddha mind?
It's called the womb of the Tathagata. Yeah. So that's the final bodhisattva place. And from there are other minds that the bodhisattva then begins to experience that end up, it's numbers and I don't remember them, but there's a whole series of, they call them boomies, B-H-U-M-I,
Because the womb to me implies origination or the birth, holding. So
yes,
it's not synonymous then. The big mind or the original mind, it's not synonymous with.
Maybe you could call the intrinsic mind the big mind that Suzuki Roshi was talking about. And then all these so-called stages are different aspects of that one mind.
And the stages is like you're talking about Buddha being enlightened. He went, he's similar to the stages that he went up and down, up and down before he's enlightened.
Yeah.
So it's, again, it's a way of talking about the mind.
Exactly. It's our clumsy way of talking about something very, very untalkaboutable, basically.
I always need reassurance here about that. Thank you.
It must be about 8 o'clock, I think, is it?
Yeah. Good time.
Yeah.